All right. Good evening, everybody. And I guess an Erev good Yom Tov. Almost. It's almost Hanukkah. 24 hours from now, we will be, God willing, celebrating the first night of Hanukkah. And obviously, it's a wonderful, wonderful time. I debated as to whether I should switch the focus for tonight and talk about Hanukkah, but I chose not to. Maybe next week we'll talk about it on Hanukkah itself, and we'll make it worthwhile. But we are up to, and I'm gonna go ahead and switch out number 126. We are up to, yes, 126. Let's open this up.
My
Hope you
book.
guys, we can share the, open this, share screen. 126, and voila, here we is. Okay. 126. All right, here we go. All right, everybody can see it. All right, Shir HaMaalos. I know by this point you should be recognizing that that is the beginning of all the ones we are doing. A Song of Ascension. When the Lord restores the fortunes of Zion, quote unquote, we see it as in a dream. Some of you might be familiar with this, and I'll sing it, in Hebrew. Shir hamalos b'shuv Hashem eshivasiyon yinok az yimalei. Does that sound familiar? Not
Yeah.
familiar with the words? Yeah. You know,
Yes.
when do we say it? When do we sing or say this psalm?
At a wedding.
Okay, the tune is definitely from a wedding, but at what point in the wedding, Liz?
When the friends are escorting the Hasan and Kala
Okay,
after the
so
ceremony.
you're right. That's the tune, but that's not these words. The song
Okay.
can use, I'll use a different tune, but the Shir HaMaalot B'shuv Hashem Eshivasiyon Yinokechamim. No, it's the psalm we say before benching. We sing a paragraph right before grace after meals on Shabbos and on Yom Tov. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this is a song of ascension. When Hashem returns back Zion, then Hayinu Kechomim, we were or we will be like dreamers. We'll have to come back to that in a moment. Our mouths shall be filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then shall they say among the nations, ah, quote, Hashem has done great things for them. Okay? Pause. This is a song of ascension. The commentaries all point out that if you remember last week we were talking about the idea that we still put our faith in God despite all of the challenges. And we talked a little bit about this word Tzion, Zion. We talked about it because we pointed out that Zion represented, like the word Tzion means a marker, a distinguishing mark, a unique description of something, like a gravestone is called a Tzion because it's a marking, the headstone. The Jewish people are also called Tzion. The temple itself was called Tzion. Jerusalem was called Tzion because they all have unique and distinguishing characteristics that make them special. So here, as a follow of what last week's was talking about, of where us praying that Hashem should, those who trust in God were like Mount Zion. Now we say when that day will come, the final redemption of the Jewish people, when we actually are returned back to Tzion, when we, Tzion, the Jewish people, are returned back to our homeland, then Hayinu kecholmim. It would be as if it were in a dream. So I got to tell you a funny joke. It was a lady, all of the many of the parshios that we are dealing with now in the reading of the Torah on Shabbos have a lot of dreams in them. Have you noticed? There's a lot of dreams. You have Jacob has the dream of the ladder and the angels going up and down. You have Joseph having his dream about the brothers and the family being bowing, their stars bowing to him. You have Pharaoh has his dream about the fat cows and the lean cows. And you have the butler and the baker have their dreams in prison with Joseph. A lot of dreams. It reminded me of a story of a woman who the night before her anniversary had a dream. Sid, you'll love this one. She has a dream that her husband gave her a gift box. And she opens the gift box and inside is another gift box. And she opens that second gift box and lo and behold, inside that, she's so excited. She opens it. There's another gift box. And finally, she opens it up. And in that fourth gift box, she opens it in this dream. And what's there? Beautiful diamond bracelet. Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous bracelet. And she wakes up from her sleep and she tells her husband about the dream she had. And she wants to know, like, what's the meaning of this dream? How do you interpret this dream? The very next day, he gives her a gift box. And she's so excited. And she opens the gift box. And inside that gift box is another gift box. And she opens box number two. And lo and behold, there's a third gift box. And she opens it and a fourth. And she finally opens it. And there in the final box, she takes it out. And it's a book that says, How to Interpret Dreams. So there's lots and lots of dreams in all of these parshios. But here we read this psalm, and it says that when Hashem brings us back, Hashem will return the captivity of Zion, we will be like dreamers. What does that mean? How are we to understand this? I think on a simple level, I'll open it to hear any of your, what are your thoughts? You hear my question? Like the sentence just doesn't seem to, on the surface, make sense. When Hashem restores back the Zion, then it's as if we were in a dream. What does that mean? What do you think?
Well, we've been wishing for it for so many years through prayer.
Good.
It's like we're waking up and it, is it real or is this a dream?
Okay, great.
Maybe the bad times were a dream. And we will wake up and it would, the dream was really a nightmare.
Okay, interesting. I like both of them. Any others? There's a lot of room for interpretation here.
Mm-hmm. Possibly that we... you know, we're not really believing that this is happening in a sense that we,
why wouldn't we believe it? We've been wanting it for so long.
Right. But we see it as a dream. We don't see it as a reality. We don't see it as like, maybe we're not worthy of it. We're not worthy of it. And it's still a dream to us. Like we're aspiring to it.
Okay. Interesting. I think we can incorporate a lot of these answers. I mean, the three that I wrote down, is one, is that it exceeds our wildest expectations. I mean, just like, it's almost as if, like when something really good happens to a person, they turn to their other person next and they go, pinch me. I must be dreaming. This right. is almost too good to believe. The feelings of ecstasy, the feelings of incredible joy when this day will come is just like a dream, like, wow. Beyond my wildest expectations. That's one. But I want to incorporate something Michelle said. And that is, you know what a dream is all about? I'm sure we've all had dreams that while we're having it, seem as vivid as can be. It's almost like it's so real. However, when you awaken from it, you realize it fades away. And it wasn't. It really was not all that I had it conjured up to be. As Michelle said, we have gone through and we continue to go through before this amazing day is going to happen. We go through all the difficulties and all of this. We have the question, God, where are you? Why are we going through all of this? But when ultimately the day comes and we're redeemed and we are brought back to Israel, and all of God's glory is recognized by the world, we will look back and see that all of those past difficulties were really nothing but a dream. They were really nothing, and they will fade away. In comparison to what this incredible experience will be like, what I thought was so vivid and real, it will fade away because it will pale in comparison. But there's a third one, and it's something I think Sid was really alluding to. And I'll see if I can explain it a little. I think this is what you were suggesting. Do you know why is it that we get to return back to the land? Why is it that we will merit to be brought back and have this ultimate redemption? Because we always dreamed of it. It was always in the forefront of our mind. We were yearning for this. We will return because we were dreamers. Can you imagine what was running through the minds of the people who were the founders of the state of Israel? They were suffering terribly in their country. And they dreamed that one day we'll have a state. One day we will go back to the land of Israel. That yearning, that dreaming of what could be, is what ultimately brings us back. It's almost the action of dreaming about it and keeping it so real is what ultimately keeps us grounded and brings us back. This is one of the most important differences when it comes to discussing Jerusalem vis-a-vis other religions. We talk about and pray for Jerusalem minimally 3 times a day. It is the centerpiece of our prayers. V'lirushalayim ircha, and to Jerusalem, your city. V'rachamim tashuv, with mercy, let us return. Bring us back to Yerushalayim. Rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. This is part and parcel of our day-to-day living, our day-to-day yearning and dreaming of that day. Other religions talk about, oh, this is our land, and there's not one mention of it in their entire Bible. In the entire Quran, Jerusalem is not mentioned. Yet they have a claim to it. We have been praying to return back to Yerushalayim. I think back to the tours that I took years ago, and they took us to the Kotel, obviously. But there's a little further down, which most people don't know about. It's actually in the Muslim quarter. It's called the Kotel Katan, the small Kotel. Anyone know about this? Yeah. If you were from a bird's eye view, follow the path of the Western Wall. Keep going into the old city. Follow it, because it's there. It's built up. You can't really see it. There's a tiny little piece of it that is actually like we have at the big Kotel, a plaza in front of it. But it's tiny. It's no bigger. The walkway is no bigger than the room in which I'm standing right now. From wall to wall is maybe, I'll be generous, I'll give it 15 feet. It's bigger than the room I'm in. That's it. That's the entire plaza, but it is there and it runs through the Muslim quarter. And I remember the guide telling us all about this, that this is approximately the most we were ever allowed, even when we were permitted to go, this tiny little area that could fit at most, if you stood crammed like sardines, maybe you can get 30, 40 people in if you're pushing it. Not 400, not 4,000, not 40,000 like we have now, thank God, at the Kotel. It was tiny, but it was always a dream. Yeah. When you have a dream and you make it the centerpiece of what it is you want, it remains in the forefront and you make it happen. Right before this class, I was at a Sheva Bracha for a young couple that got married a few days ago. And I spoke about this concept about dreaming, because as I said, all of these parshios talk about it. And I said one of the greatest messages that we see from all of the dreams, especially with the butler and the baker, why did one merit that their dream was fulfilled and was returned back to his post as the wine steward, and the other whose dream spelled his demise and he was hanged by Pharaoh? Why? Why was one good and one bad interpretation? The answer that some of the commentaries give us is that if you read the text carefully, the wine steward said he went ahead and he squeezed the grapes, right? If you read the terminology of the story, you guys know what I'm talking about. It's this week's Torah portion, in fact. Here's what it says. He said he had a dream. He says to him, in my dream, behold, there was a grapevine in front of me. On the grapevine were three tendrils, and it was thought, and it was as though it budded. Its blossoms bloomed and its clusters ripened into grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I placed the cup on fire in Pharaoh's palm. That's the wine steward. I want you to focus. I'll give you the answer. I won't even make you think. He talks about actions he did. I took those grapes and I squeezed them. I put them into the cup. I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Action, action, action. Let's contrast that with the baker. The baker says, I too, in my dream, behold, three wicker baskets were on my head, and in the uppermost basket were all kinds of Pharaoh's food, baker's handiwork, and the birds were eating them from the basket above my head. What did he do?
Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He's just recounting a story. Doesn't say, I bake the bread. I put them in the basket. I shooed and chased away the birds. Doesn't say anything. Joseph hears in the story of it, of the two dreams. One of them, he hears somebody who dreams, but it's about an action to make the dream a reality. That's the wine steward. I went ahead and I squeezed the grapes and I put it into the cup and I put the cup in Pharaoh's hands because that's what I want. I'm dreaming about going back to my service. The baker? Baker says, and I had a basket and in it were three breads and the birds came and they ate. What? He did nothing. A dream like that doesn't get fulfilled. That you don't get fulfilled. As Sid said, do you know why this is a song of ascension? When Hashem brings us back, what was the reason why God brought us back? Because hayinu kicholmim, we were always dreaming of this moment. This was in the forefront of our minds. We never gave up. We always said we want to go back to the land of Israel. We can't wait to serve Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash again. When it's such a dream, that's such a reality of what you want, it becomes fulfilled. That's why it says, when this day comes, we will look back and say, you know why it came about? Because we were dreamers. We always kept this in the forefront of our mind. Great understanding. What we need to always remember. If you think about it, isn't that really the story of what we want in life? We have dreams for what we want to accomplish in life. We want to do certain things, whether it's professionally, as a family, as a unit, as a community person, as a member of shul. We have pictures in our head of what we want to accomplish. We dream of what could be. But the only way those dreams become fulfilled into a reality is when you put in the time and effort. It's not a guarantee, but it's a guarantee if you don't, it's not going to happen. That's guaranteed. But this is what's going on. Now, I want to point out, I don't know if we're going to ultimately get this far, but there's another psalm, Psalm 137. 137 is what many people have the custom to say before benching on a weekday. The one that we're studying, 126, is reserved for Shabbos and Yom Tov. But there's one, the famous one of Al Naros Bavel, by the rivers of Babylon. Now, you guys know that song. Psalm 137. That the custom is, what's there in that psalm? It describes as the Jews were being sent into exile by the Babylonians after the first temple was destroyed. We had to go and cross over all the rivers by Babel, by Babylon. And we cried there how much we already were missing and yearning to go back to the land of Israel. That psalm is said on a weekday. Our psalm is said and reserved for Shabbos and Yom Tov. Why? Why the distinction? So again, the commentaries pointed out so beautifully. And that is, before the benching on a weekday, in order to keep the memory of the fact that the temple was destroyed, keep it fresh in our minds, even when our bodies are sated and comfortable after eating a great meal in exile, I don't want to forget. And I remind myself of the destruction of the temple, of what it is I want back. But comes along, Psalm 126 is recited before benching on Shabbos and Yom Tov. These are holy and festive days that afford everybody, even exiled Jews, a glimpse of what the future holds. A world that is like a regular Shabbos, a Shabbos where the world is at peace. You don't have that work ethic, that not so much the ethic. You're not doing the work. You're handing it back over to God. That's what Shabbos is. It's a day of rest, of where everything is in harmony and everything is at peace. I don't necessarily need the reminder of what I'm missing. It's a taste of what I can have. So on the weekday, I remind myself of what I'm missing. And on Shabbos, I thank Hashem for the opportunity of what eventually I will have. That is how they differentiate between the two. Okay. But I want to point out one more piece. And I'm being very particular in the reading of it. In that first sentence, a song of ascents, Bishuv Hashem, when Hashem returns, et Shivat Zion. The word et or s doesn't really have a good English translation. It's one of those Hebrew words that's really just a conjunction with what's next to it. But it doesn't really have a meaning by itself. I don't know what they call this. There's some grammar term of what it's called. But the word S doesn't have. Like, for example, take the first sentence in the Torah. Bereshit bara Elokim, in the beginning of Hashem creating, et hashamayim. We translate as the heavens. Well, that's the word hashamayim. The word et hashamayim, the word et is not adding anything to the sentence. And ve'et haaretz, and the earth. In the beginning of Hashem creating the heavens and the earth. You can leave out the words et. Just say, Bereshit bara Elokim hashamayim veharetz. The heavens and the earth. The word et doesn't seem to have. Our sages teach us, Rabbi Akiva, by the way, is the one who was able to understand what additional information is being conveyed with every et in the Torah. The way I understand it, is that the word et is trying to hint at there's something more than just that word. I'll give you a perfect example. Okay? Follow me. If I lose you, please stop me. But I think we should be able to get this across. One of the Ten Commandments, honor your mother and father. Right? We're familiar with that. Kabed, I'll read you the Hebrew words. Five words. Kabed, honor. Et avicha, your father, ve'et imecha, and your mother. Kabed et avicha ve'et imecha. Honor your father and your mother. There's two et in there. Kabed et avicha. Honor et your father. Ve'et imecha, and et your mother. The word et. Rabbi Akiva says it's coming to teach us there's something more. When you see the word et, it means to take the word it's connected to and extend it to that concept one more step. So in this example, honor your father. It's coming to include not just your father, but your older brother. Your oldest brother, even. You say, really? Well, you got to remember, the oldest male was often the one that after the father passed away, took responsibility to support the family, right? That's the one that went out to work, the first one to do it, because without the father, there was nobody helping to take care of the family. So the Torah recognized it and says that besides for the honor one is obligated to give to his father, should show some respect to his older brother. How do you know that? Because et avicha, who is the closest person to the father that represents what the father does for the family, other than the mother, which we'll talk about in a moment, is the older brother. So the word et means to extend the concept of that word, in this case, your father, extend it one level. Who's the closest to represent the father? It's the older brother. Okay? And similarly with all the other ets in the Torah. Here we have our word in verse 1. A song of ascension. Bishuv Hashem, when Hashem returns, et Shivat Zion, the returnees of Zion. Who else? Who else is being returned if not for the Jewish people? Who else is in exile that is being returned when this incredible redemption comes about? Who else? Robin?
Shem.
Yes! God himself. Excellent. This is something that's such an important concept that gets glossed over. We think about it that God is sitting up in heaven and God remains in heaven even under the good times, even in the bad times. God is still sitting on his luxurious throne of glory, and everything is hunky-dory for God. Not true. I'm not talking, obviously, in the physical sense, but in a symbolic way of a conceptual idea. When the Jewish people are in exile, God feels he's in exile too. I'll give you the perfect example that you knew of. When God came to Moses to tell him the time has come to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, where and when was that first communication when God spoke to him? Where and when?
The burning the bush.
That is correct. Of all the different places God could have spoken to Moshe from, remember, Moses is living in the country of Midian. I'm sure there are trees in Midian. I'm sure there are beautiful, nice areas that are shady. Got maybe even a park bench somewhere. I'm sure there's a nice, comfortable Holiday Inn he could have gotten his attention. He speaks to him from a lowly thorn bush. Our sages pick up on this and they point out that it's exactly what God was conveying to him. Moshe, I know that your brothers and sisters are in exile in Egypt and they are suffering. I want you to know I feel that too. I come to you in a lowly thorn bush. I'm not sitting pretty. I'm not the Imo Anochi Bitzara. I am with you in your pain. This is a concept of where when we are in exile, God's presence is in exile. We daven on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We ask God, Gale Kivod Malchus Chaleinu, reveal to us the glory of your kingship. What do you mean reveal to us? Where is it? It should be abundantly clear, but it's not, because God is in exile too. This is exactly what's being alluded to here. When Hashem returns et Shivas Tzion. Besides for the returnees of Zion, I myself now get to go back and have a sense of place in this world. When the Beit HaMikdash will be returned and my presence can come back down here to earth. I'm also in exile. What does that mean he's in exile? He's forgotten by the world. It's almost as if he doesn't exist. Who recognizes God? The darkness that abounds in the world begs the question, where are you, God? Where are you? God says, I'm in exile too. I'm not sitting on my throne, so to say. Very, very important idea. He too will be brought back out of exile. We go to verse 2. You know what will be when that day will come? Then, us, Yamali, then our mouths. I don't know why that word is missing in the translation. It's when the Lord restores the fortune of Zion, we see it as a dream. Then our mouths shall be filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. As much as we are able to celebrate, even nowadays, and it's important that we do, we have to remember that the celebration is somewhat curtailed. We can't fully be engaged with laughter and celebration and joy. What's the classic example of how we keep this in mind at the height of our joy? What do? Think of a wedding.
Break the glass?
Yes, that's exactly right. We break a glass. Some people will tell you it's because it's the last time that the groom gets to put his foot down on any issue. There's truth to that. But the real reason, or one of the reasons that's brought down, that the source of that custom of breaking the glass at the wedding is because this verse says that only at that point of redemption, when that day will come, can we be filled with joy. Can we be filled with that sense of gladness? Till that time, it's somewhat curtailed. It's somewhat held back. When will that be? That lack, it's then at that point, the other nations of the world will finally recognize and they'll say, yes, we recognize how Hashem has done great things for the Jewish people. The nations are surprised. When that day of redemption comes, they're going to be surprised at the success and the redemption of the Jewish people. What do you mean? We always held them in the lowest of esteem. They were always the scapegoat of everything. They were the cause of all the troubles in the world. And now they see God elevating them, redeeming them. They'll finally get the point. They'll finally understand and will admit that it must be because Higdil Hashem, God, has done all these great things for them. See, we knew it all along. That was last week's psalm. We had the trust in Hashem even in the midst of the most bitter exile. But the other nations don't see that. It's only once we are redeemed, they will look back and say, man, we missed the boat. God has done all these great things for them. We knew all along. We were glad even in exile. We trusted in Hashem that the day would come. They are the ones who will be surprised. The Lord will do great things for us. See, I don't like this translation. This is not he will do. Higdil Hashem lasot imanu should be translated as almost as if a prayer. Hashem has done greatly with us. We were gladdened. And therefore, number 4, we ask of you, Hashem, restore us, return our captivity like springs in the desert. Okay, like water courses in the Negev. Negev is the desert, the southern part of Israel. Such a great picture. Springs in the desert. You know, if you try to plant something in the desert, good luck. It's going to be very, very difficult. It's going to be very challenging to go ahead and do that. Can you imagine if you try to plant and all of a sudden, right, and you wonder how anything can flourish, but unexpectedly, all of a sudden, a spring starts to flow. You think your level of joy will be high? I would think. It's so unexpected. Like water in the Negev. Those who sow in tears shall reap with songs of joy. Great, great expression. See it? Number 5. Those who see the seeds in tears will reap with songs of joy. What kind of seeds are we sowing? What does this mean? Those who sow, again, given the context that this is all about the final redemption and the joy and celebration that we will experience, how the nations will be shocked that this has all happened. And we ask Hashem to make it happen now. Restore us. Bring us back. Like a sudden spring that comes forth in the desert. King David says, those who sow in tears will reap with song? What does that mean? Come on, Susan, right up your alley. What kind of seeds do we sow that we're asking Hashem that we're doing it in tears, no less? What is it that we're sowing? What seeds? I would say the seeds. Go ahead, Robin.
Is it the Torah?
Yes, I think that is the right answer. The seeds of our commitment to Torah and mitzvos, which we do with tears in our eyes. Because which point of our history do you want me to focus on, of where we weren't persecuted for sowing seeds of Torah and mitzvos? There's never been a situation. We plant them and we sow them with tears because we suffer through it. We're mocked by the world. We cry, both physically and spiritually. But we sow those seeds of Torah and mitzvos that are drenched by the tears of the hardships, the oppression, the persecution, the suffering. Here King David says, those who sow in tears, when this day will come, you will reap those tears. You will reap those seeds. Ultimately, you will harvest these incredible things with song and jubilation. Yes. They are difficult. But even, notice it says that those who sow in tears will reap. You, even before the reaping, it's actually, if you look at the Hebrew, it's the opposite of the English. In English, it's reaping with song of joy. In the Hebrew, the last two words of that sentence are, with song shall you reap. It's the same message. But you'll note the order is very different. And again, the commentaries point out that even joyous, you're already, the songs are exuding from the people even before the reaping. Why? Because that confidence in Hashem has already been planted from years and years and years of sowing those seeds. You will burst out with song even before you actually harvest it. Halach yelech uvacho, though he goes along weeping, nose meshech hazara, carrying the bag of seeds, goes along weeping as he goes and tries to plant these seeds. But, bayavo, but when he comes back, berina, it will be with joy, will be with song, nose alumosav, as he carries his sheaves. The symbolic nature is so apropos when we go through a hard time. The Jewish people are bearing these seeds in a barren desert of a world that weeps as it journeys through. It goes, it's hard. As we go through Jewish history, we try planting seeds. We try, we try, we try. We become successful. In almost every single case of every single country that we've ever been in, we have succeeded. You think about it. It's an incredible against all the odds. How does an immigrant people become so ingrained in a new country to the point of where they rise to the greatest positions of that country? In Spain, in France, in the United States, pick a place in Russia. They were always, the Jews were always the ones. Perhaps that's why everybody was so jealous. Hence a level of anti-Semitism. But we did it. But we knew we were trying to plant seeds of Torah and mitzvos, of connection, of spirituality. I think back, you know, I say this every year at the Passover Seder. We talk about that Hashem freed us. God liberated us and took us out. And they ask the question, do you mean to tell me the Jews who lived in Russia or the Jews who lived in Iran and Iraq over the past few years, right? Before the Iron Curtain came down, before the Jews were able to be smuggled out of Iraq and Iran, before the Jews, you know, how did they celebrate their Pesach Seder? In secrecy and hiding under the threat that the KGB would find them? Really? Dad, Mom, what are we talking about? God redeemed us? We're in exile again. I feel like we're back in Egypt. Mom, Dad, doesn't it feel that way? How can we sit here talking about being free people? We don't feel free. Do you ever have that question? Thank God we don't know it personally. We live in this country that we have this freedom. But for the majority of Jewish history, we did not have this. So how could they sit around the Seder and talk about being free people? Now we are slaves. L'shana haba b'nei chorin. We're going to be free. What are you talking about? We're stuck behind an iron fist of some ruler, some tyrant. The next pogrom is right around the corner. They're going to capture us. They're going to send us to Siberia, to the gulag for 40 years. How can you say that? The answer that I have seen years ago, and I say this over every year at my Seder, is a beautiful analogy. An analogy, a story, a parable that's told about a very, very poor man. Very, very poor, destitute. And he has to collect money every day just to survive. And the story goes that he starts collecting and he comes across a fellow and the fellow is willing to give him a dollar. And he says to him, I want you to go ahead and take this dollar and buy a lottery ticket. Yes, I know it sounds weird, but trust me, I think this is your lucky day. The guy goes ahead and sure enough, he says, I got nothing to lose. He buys a lottery ticket and sure enough, he wins. He wins an incredible amount of money. And what does he do with it? So yeah, he buys himself clothing, buys himself a home to live in. He buys himself transportation. He buys himself, but he also buys himself a tutor. He never had the opportunity to become educated. He had to work. You know, he was orphaned as a young boy. And he goes ahead and he gets himself a tutor and he becomes educated in math and science and Judaism and all the things that he's important in his life. And every year on the anniversary of winning the lottery, he would make a party to celebrate. And of course, he would invite his friends, which now, of course, he had many, right? Because now he's rich. He's got plenty of friends and they come and they celebrate and with great, he decks out with food and drink and everything you can imagine. And this is how it went for year after year after year. Unfortunately, after a few years, he made a couple of bad investments and he lost a significant amount of his wealth. And then something else happened. And the next thing you know, he's almost back to where he started. And he's left penniless again. And he's out begging on the street. And it comes now the anniversary of when he won all the money in the lottery. And he invites his friends to a very small celebration. And the few friends who are even willing to be friends with him anymore say to him, why are you making a celebration? You've lost all your money. There's nothing left. What are you celebrating? And he said to them, you're right. The car is gone. The house is gone. The beautiful stuff that I enjoyed, those are all gone. But don't forget, I hired a tutor and I became educated. I became knowledgeable of who I am, what my abilities are, and what it means to be a Jew. And that nobody can take away from me, no matter what. That's something that's mine that I acquired that no one can take away. And for that, it's worth celebrating. This is the mashal. This is the parable that was told that when the Jews are in Russia, when they're suffering under the KGB and all these other difficult situations, you're right. I don't have that sense of freedom. But you know what? Right after I left Egypt, God gave us a Torah. God tutored us and gave us education, gave us knowledge of who we are as a people. And that no KGB can take away. No Tehran can take away from us. No Ayatollah can take away from us, no matter what the situation. We became enriched by it. I believe that this is really the insight that's being conveyed in verse 5 and 6. We sow our seeds in tears because we do go through hardships. We do. It's hard. But the ultimate redemption will show us that we will have reaped and harvested unbelievable things with joy. We went along carrying the seeds as we went from country to country, from exile to exile, from difficult time to difficult time. And we went along weeping, trying to plant those seeds that there is more to life than just the fast cars, easy money. There's something much more. And for that, we will come back carrying loaves, sheaves and sheaves and bundles, because we will have taught the world a valuable lesson about what really matters in the world. And that is knowledge. That is connection. Do you know what the word mitzvah means? The word itself, what does it mean? We normally translate it as commandment, and that's not wrong. It's related to the word tzivui. Tzivui is a command, but it has a secondary meaning. Litzavos means to connect, to have a connection. Doing mitzvos is creating a connection between the greatest master of the universe and me. Little old me. I'm just one of 7 billion people. I'm just one of so many. But I have a personal relationship with the master of the universe? Wow. Wow. How do I create that connection? The word mitzvah. By performing mitzvos, by taking in the Torah that God has given us as the instruction manual to have and forge, nurture our relationship with him. That's how we do it. Tough times, yes, but the day will come that we will bear, B-E-A-R. I'm from New York. I have a hard time saying that word. We will bear our sheaves of the hard work and the success by having planted it in every country around the world. We will have that ability to do that. So this chapter, this psalm, is all about what will become when that final redemption comes. But I want to add one tiny piece more, and then I'll take questions. I want to read you. I'm very into Rav Kook now. I quote him almost now every week. Rav Kook on this psalm, I want to read you his term. He also is bothered by the fact that it talks in future tense, right? That God, when God brings us back, but then when it says we were like dreamers, it's past tense. It's very much in line with what Sid was saying, but I want you to hear the words of Rav Kook. He says, we need to understand the importance of our dreams and how they are connected to our national redemption. We know of historical incidents where dreams served as a vehicle to redemption. Joseph became the viceroy of Egypt and rescued his family from famine through Pharaoh's dreams. Daniel attained his position of importance through the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. What is the function of dreams in this world? Says Rav Kook, every soul has certain segulot, hidden talents or qualities. The greater the trait, the more it will struggle to be realized. One way in which these inner qualities express themselves is through the medium of dreams. The nation of Israel also has special segulot, a unique potential for spiritual greatness. This drive for national self-fulfillment, that is the source of our dreams of redemption. Skipping here. This is true for the individual and the entire nation as well. Secreted in the national soul of Israel is a potential for greatness. By remembering and anticipating this national destiny, we strengthen it and prime it to be realized. That's what Sid was saying before. The more you dream it, the more you are making it primed for becoming a reality. The value of anticipating redemption lies in its power to help bring it to fruition. This is not a mystical belief, but a simple historical fact. Without a doubt, the unprecedented return of the Jewish people to their homeland after centuries of stateless exile could not have occurred without their constant yearnings and prayers. The Zionist movement could not have convinced millions of Jews to uproot themselves if not for the people's deep-rooted longings for the land of Israel. It is our faith and anticipation of redemption that enables the realization of Israel's national segula. This is what the psalm means. We were like dreamers in past tense. The psalmist is referring to our dreams of redemption during the long years of exile. He's not describing a state of euphoria during the hour of redemption, but the means which enable this redemption to take place. That's, I'm sure, word for word what Sid was saying. Wink, wink. At least close. Was I close, Sid? That's what you were trying to say. God will bring about the return of Zion. Why? Because throughout the ages, hayinu cholmim, we were like dreamers. Our dreams and faith in God's promised redemption enabled our return to the land of Israel. Never give up on your dreams. Never. At whatever stage in life, keep dreaming. Keep dreaming, because the more you dream it, and I'm not talking only in a sleep state, I'm talking about what you picture, what your vision is for tomorrow, for the next day. Where do I want to see myself tomorrow? And don't get philosophical on me, right? Don't even come down and say, I'm so old, I just want to make sure I have tomorrow. I want to hear it. Everybody, for you to get up in the morning, you still have to have a dream of what you want to accomplish. Our psalm teaches us, keep dreaming, because as you dream it, it becomes your reality. You enable that to ultimately come about. It's true on a personal level, and it's very true on a national level. And that is what this psalm is all about. So next, this Shabbos, before you do grace after meals, before you do benching, look in your bencher, look in your book. You will see our psalm, Psalm 126. Read it. Think of a song that goes for it, but read it and you'll remember our conversation tonight. Every Shabbos, every Yom Tov, before benching, say this paragraph, sing it, and you'll remind yourself, keep dreaming. Dreams create the reality because it remains fresh in our minds. Questions? Yes, Fred.
Well, more of a statement. I've always felt that the reason we as Jews have overcome so many things and always reached the top in so many, whether it be countries or fields, education is part of our religion. And not to point out any other people, but when I would hear certain groups struggling and looking for help, and I would think, well, we as a people, I remember coming here, like I say, back in 41 when, you know, Jews were not welcomed, in 44 when Jews were not welcomed on the beach. But it was the education, I believe, through all of those years, going way back in time, that kept us where we are today, because through education, we did it when you couldn't get it elsewhere. It was in the home. It was and the Torah, when you really study it, it's not reading things, you're interpreting, you're learning. And that in itself is a form of education.
Correct. I would say it's the ultimate, because it's not just academic knowledge. Right. It's supposed to be transformative of a better person I can become.
Yeah. That's what the word
Torah means. Torah doesn't mean Bible. Torah means instruction.
It's an instruction manual for living, for mankind. That's what it is.
So, yeah, I agree 100%. Education, we are called the people of the book for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
We very much value education because it gives us the tool to be able to make decisions. Educated decisions are, that's ultimately what we ask of everybody. For any decision in life, it should be educated. Mm-hmm. To do a decision, certainly important ones that are based on ignorance, it's a shot in the dark. Who knows? Not tooting our horn, but that's really the motto of what Shoresh is. is to educate Jews to make educated Jewish decisions. Mm-hmm. I'm not telling you what to do, but I want to educate you. What does the Torah say? What does Judaism teach us? Now right. It's your job to incorporate it. But it's all about education. It absolutely is. Yep. Good point. Anything else? Can't see everybody on the screens. Let me close this. There we go.
There we go.
I see everybody. Yes.
By the way, the translation I have in my book says what you said you wish it would say in yours. Then our mouths were filled.
Yes, that's the word that needs to be there. Then.
Good. I've got it.
The first word, because the first word in Hebrew is us. Us means then. Then our mouths will be filled. Mm-hmm. Yes, Susan. Queen or Princess Susan?
It's my birthday today, so that's why.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Many good health.
Thank you. Shameless advertising. So here's the question. And if it's out of field, please let me know. I recall, and I think this could have come from two different places. I think from when we studied the alphabet, the letters, and some Kabbalistic teaching that et signifies, the entire alphabet, correct? From Aleph, okay. So, is there an additional signifier for regarding the placement near the word it's extending? Is there another connection related to the Aleph and the tet?
If you think about it, it's really the same concept.
Okay.
The truth of the matter is, I didn't want to get into the grammar of it. But the root of the word, it's a whole talk. You know, you've heard me quote Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Rav Hirsch.
Yes.
I love it. He has an entire system of etymology when it comes to the Hebrew language. He basically breaks it down that all of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet come from one of five places that produce sound in our mouth. Some letters are guttural. Right? They really are like the letter ch, yes, which everybody like, what? Yes. Certain letters are guttural. Certain letters are dependent on the teeth for me to pronounce them. I can't say, right, certain letters. Certain letters are the tongue against the palate. There's five areas of your mouth of how all them. The letters that are in the same grouping have a relationship to each other. So, for example, the letters bet, right? Bays, b is a lip letter. You can't say the letter bays without moving your lips. Try it. Clench your teeth and try to say bet. You can't do it.
Not possible.
It's your lips. Bet, right? Mem. Pay. Vav. There's four that fit into that case. It's called bump. That's how I remember it. It's a bump. Beis, Vav, Mem, and Pe. Okay? That means when you look at the root of a word, let's say the bet is part of the root of the word, for you to appreciate and extend the understanding of that word, you can swap out anyone within the context of that same category. So if you want to understand the word, or I don't know, I'm making one up here, right? Barech, which means to bless, bet, resh, chaf, you can swap out a bet for the mem and the resh for a different one, and it gives you another understanding. It's within the same category. It's within this, but you've expanded the understanding and definition.
Okay.
The root of the word et, the letter tav, and dalid are tongue letters. Dalid. Tav. Right? Rav Hirsch writes that the word et is related to the word ud, because he swaps out the tav and the dalid. And ud is a handle, like if a pot, right? If you had to pick up a pot that had no handle, it's going to hurt, right? Even with pot holders. The handle, if you think about what a handle is, A handle is an extension of the pot. It's not the pot. But what it does is it gives you an ability to access the pot by extending it and creating a handle.
Wow.
That's what he writes. Hence, the word et is a handle, an extension of whatever word it's connected to.
Wow.
Example of honor et avicha, your father, you build an extension, a handle. Who is the most logical extension, handle for the father? It's the older brother. Every et in the world. Now, based on that understanding, it fits beautifully. We're aleph to tav, because basically everything now gets opened up to extend to something more. Might it be closer to the aleph? Might it be closer to the tav? I don't know. But it's an extension and a handle on it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said when I first learned it.
Wow. So I had, because really I was sitting here, I will need to listen to the recording again, because as soon as you raised up the et to me, I had some memory from previous that being up, and when you talked about the extension, I'm saying there must be a dot or several to connect. I'm so excited about this. I could probably spend like a year figuring out now what the categories and stuff.
I'll tell you the honest truth. This goes back. Oh my gosh! At this point, it was probably 1996, maybe 97, something like that. I was learning in the Kollel in Columbus. That was the resource center that I was a part of, and I was fortunate to be able to spend part of my day continuing to learn and study. And I came to the understanding that every time the Talmud would quote a verse, I found myself running to the bookshelf to see how did Rav Hirsch understand that verse. I'm curious how to, that's the one, Fred. That's the rabbi, but that's the shortened version of his, that's a select commentary. Fantastic. He wrote a five volume massive work on the Torah. They've redone it because he originally wrote it in German, and he wrote very poetically, and he wrote fancy calligraphy. It was like, I certainly don't understand it, but it was translated into English, and it's very difficult English. I spent months and months and months and months working on it till I finally. So the reason I'm telling you this story is because I finally had this epiphany. Why don't I publish a dictionary according to Rav Hirsch's understanding of etymology? Can you imagine if you had the opportunity to look up and say, oh, I would love to know when this word bereshit in the beginning, why does the root of the word Rosh mean beginning? Open up a dictionary according to Rav Hirsch, and you look under Resh, and and it tells you all the other words related to it. I had this grandiose plan, and I took index cards, and every time I came across a word and I looked up how Rav Hirsch understood it, I started writing index cards and Aleph, and then I came to one with a Gimel, and I started doing it. Didn't get too far. And one of my colleagues comes to me and says, you'll never believe it. I just found in one of the publishing companies, someone just published, and it's called The Dictionary According to Rav Hirsch. Wow. And it did an outstanding job.
Wow.
Way better than I would have done. It's excellent. Now, before you run out and go to Amazon and buy it, I'll just have you know, it's not the way I just explained it. It will give you all the reference points of where you can look it up in Rav Hirsch. He's literally like a dictionary. Here's the word. Here's the phonetic cognates. Here's the words associated with it. And it means this, 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 and this, and this. Here's where you find it. Go check it out. My 15-minute explanation is not in the dictionary. That's my hard work.
Uh-huh.
That I thought was such a someone beat me to it.
Yeah, I used to read his commentary. This is 1997, the edition I have.
Yeah, that again, that's a great work. It gives you a flavor of what it's all about. But just know, do I have it? I don't have it here. No. I will tell you, here's Rav Hirsch just on Psalms. It's a big fat book. Every verse. Look at all the commentary.
Wow.
This is
and that's published in English.
This is the translation, and this is his commentary. Every page, every verse.
How many volumes?
The Psalms is one. Psalms is one. One whole book.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's difficult reading. It's difficult English. I'm not even talking about the Hebrew. They've reprinted Rav Hirsch's commentary on the Torah a second time. Someone spent a lot of time modernizing the English so that it flows a lot easier for us English speaking. But be that as it may. Susan, that was one of my most astounding and appreciative teachings of Rav Hirsch. Because once you understand that every et is an ud, is a handle to extend, then when you come across it 1,000 times in the Torah, you're left with the question, how does the Talmud translate this et? How does it learn? What does it learn? For example, the verse says, et Hashem Elokecha tira. Hashem, your God, you shall show reverence for. But it starts with the word et. Who else am I supposed to have reverence for? Says the Talmud, Torah sages. Torah sages who are the human teachers of God's Torah. If you show reverence for God, then the ones who are giving and sharing God's Torah, God's wisdom, are also deserving of some reverence. They are the extension. They are the handle. Every one of them all of a sudden starts making sense.
Maybe that's your next class.
You're funny. I am.
Etashamayim for etaharetz. I mean, it's impossible.
What's it coming to include? It's not heaven and earth.
It's impossible to go like two lines without it. You know, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
It's everywhere.
It's unbelievable.
It is.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. And the Talmud and other sources, they all say, what is being taught by this? Because there's nothing extra. Even the seemingly, I'll use the word, untranslatable. It's only untranslatable in English. In Hebrew, it means and plus. Whatever it is, plus. If you want to say that there were 100 plus people at an event, why do you say that? Because, you know, it's 100 and something. So here it's the same thing. Whatever the word, think of the word plus. That's what the word et is. Brilliant, 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 brilliant. Okay, so you got two great things tonight. One, an understanding of Psalms, and number two, your Hebrew grammar lesson of the year.
By the way, Rabbi, is his book a good book to look into for Psalms, or is there a better book for the explanations of Psalms?
I can't wait. You know, they're all good. They're all great.
Yeah.
My suggestion is, if you have an opportunity and you go to a bookstore, if you come into Baltimore once, go to Shopsies and look at all the different ones. Find one that talks to you. There's no one right answer. I'm not going to say, oh, this is the one you have to read. There's so many out there. Look through it. Go in there, spend a half hour, open them up, read a couple of paragraphs and say, oh, this I understand. You read this one, you're like, I have no idea what he's talking about. No clue. He's quoting stuff. I don't even know what planet he's on. Right. There are those commentaries also. So you just got to find one that speaks to you. Sharon.
Still trying to get to Shopsy. Anyway, you made a comment about how it, when speaking Hebrew, some parts with your teeth, some part with your tongue.
Right.
And Elisha Sheva, who just turned 18, my granddaughter, she was about 10 and she was teaching me some different words and I just wasn't saying it right. And she goes, Grandma, you're just not using the right part of your tongue.
There you go. Exactly.
Wow.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It sounds funny, but once it's explained, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
The way we pronounce letters, depending on which part, it's amazing. That means there's a relationship. Some are a harder consonant, some are a softer one, but there's a relationship. That's what Rav Hirsch's etymology is all about. That's the basics. Anyway, held you hostage long enough. All right. Have a great rest of the week, everyone. And happy Hanukkah tomorrow night. I will try my best. I will send out a reminder, but I am planning. I will speak, Robin. I will reach out to David.
What? It's actually the thing that they're having at Baker Park is at 6:30, so it'll probably be done by 7:30. So it's probably okay.
I start at 8.
Yeah, it's probably okay if you come at 8, but I don't know because somebody has to.
I'll reach out to David. I'll reach out to him.
He might want you 7:30 instead of 8. I don't know. But
okay.
I'm just saying, just because if he's done and they have to be in the, I have no idea, but okay. Hopefully he'll figure it out.
That's fine.
And fine. That'll be next week.
But I will let you, I'll do that sooner rather than later so we can make plans accordingly.
Is there going to be like some food?
I know that I'm going to be in Frederick. I'm going to be in Frederick anyway because I purposely set up that I can do my teen class from 6:30 to 7:30.
Okay, so this will have to be 7:45 or 8, yeah.
Well, if I have to, I'll stay in Starbucks and I'll do my Zoom class from there. And then everybody can hear my take on Hanukkah.
No, so I thought, I'm sorry, if you were coming to the synagogue, I thought, is this the thing like with the alcohol and the food or no?
What?
Is this just the class or is this the alcohol and the food?
I wasn't bringing alcohol. Nice try.
Alcohol?
Wasn't bringing
looking for latkes.
I was going to bring some Hanukkah treats and gifts or whatever, but it's not going to be a whole, it's our group. I was going to make some fun, have a good fun class.
I kind of missed something, but when is that?
I'm planning on doing it next Wednesday, but Robin pointed out that Beth Shalom has something that evening. So I have to reach out to the executive director and see if I can coordinate to come right afterwards and we can still do it in person. Listen, if it doesn't work and the majority or all of you prefer that we just keep it as is and we'll save it for another time, that's fine with me also.
You're going to be in Frederick, so it makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
I'll reach out to him. I'm going to put it on my calendar for tomorrow and I'll send out an email. And we'll do it accordingly.
And by the way, that quiz you did last year, where the question was the color of manna. I remember actually I was reading in the Torah one of the days, and it actually said white. And I said, I'll be darned. There's the answer.
Look at that. He doesn't lie.
You weren't just making
He's
it
not
up.
Making unless... stuff up. I can't believe it. What are the odds?
I'm thinking, where did you learn that? And then there it was. There it was.
Unbelievable. I tell you, this book's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 3,200 years. All right. Good night, everybody.
Happy birthday, Susan.
I'll let you know.